Jane Ann Morris, Democracy Theme Park. Under a huge sky with ominous clouds, the black and white photo of the Galveston, Texas amusement park shows the silhouettes of Ferris wheel and roller coaster. This is the website of Jane Ann Morris, self-described corporate anthropologist. The navigation bar leads to her books, blogs, and articles. Jane Ann Morris was one of the principal members of the Program on Corporations, Law and Democracy, POCLAD.org, a think tank of about a dozen wise individuals that included Richard Grossman. He worked on dismantling corporations. They came together in the early 1990s to better understand why all of our activism against corporations that are causing harm to people and nature was so unbelievably ineffective. DemocracyThemePark.org is Jane Ann Morris' precious gift to us. She died on May 28, 2019, in Madison, Wisconsin. And this is a tribute to her work. And this is the way she wanted us to enter her website. She wrote, "I first brought up the idea of the Democracy Theme Park, the place where you play at pulling the levers of democracy, only to discover they aren't connected to anything, at a conference in Texas, 1996. Before and since, while we've been writing letters to our representatives and talking to 12 people at a time in living rooms, corporate executives have continued writing laws and buying television stations. They're making policy while we're standing in line for rides at the Democracy Theme Park. But we don't have to stay here. We too can develop provocative and nuanced strategies for returning democracy to what it was supposed to be all about: government for the people, by the people. So hang on to your hats and sharpen your pencils. We're going over the wall, but first, take a step back to 1996. What I said then is still, alas, deeply relevant." End quote. Here's Jane Ann Morris.
I think we're going to have to stop a lot of this clapping or we're never going to get to any of the substance here, but thank you for welcoming me. Greetings from the People's Republic of Wisconsin, and thank you very, very much for inviting me to the Lone Star State. I lived in Texas for close to 20 years and just moved to Wisconsin 2 years ago. Wisconsin shares a lot of things with Texas, and one of them is a strong populist tradition, and we've all been hearing about that, and I'm going to be referring to that today also. Of my time in Texas, I have to say I didn't spend as much of it as I should have walking around in beautiful places like this, because I spent a great deal of it in the Texas Railroad Commission. The Texas Railroad Commission is the regulatory agency in Texas, which of course regulates uranium mining, oil and gas exploration, and lignite strip mining, among other things. I spent a lot of my time there because, as has been mentioned, there was a big struggle about potential lignite strip mining in the state. I later wrote a 700-page dissertation about how a public utility company basically got away with everything they wanted in the Railroad Commission and other regulatory agencies, and I later wrote an activist book on it. So today I'm going to be using regulatory agencies as a kind of way of talking about the way we do activism in our government, because we do live in a regulatory state and have for a century, and much of our activism is dominated by a concern with working through regulatory agencies. Other than voting, letters to representatives and congresspeople, and strikes, regulatory agencies are a main part of how we exercise our democracy in this country. Now, when we began our regulatory fight in the late 1970s, early 1980s, many of us were fairly green at this, but we got a lot of advice. As you know, when you have a really big problem, there are usually all kinds of people out there ready to give you advice. The advice we got was things like the following. You know, you're going to have to read all those reports. You're going to have to learn to speak their language. Then they said, and you know what? You're going to have to find experts. We found experts. They said, you're going to have to hire a lawyer. That one was a real toughie because that meant long hours of bake sales, and bake sales got really old, and that I'm literally saying that was how we did it. This was a very low-budget operation. They also said, you're going to have to learn to write press releases and have press conferences, and we thought, okay, but some among the group learned to do that. And then they said, and you know, it doesn't matter how many lies you hear them telling, as you're sitting there in the regulatory agency or as they're giving press conferences and so on, you're going to have to act respectful. So we heard all the lies, but we acted respectful. They also said things like, you know, they're not really going to listen to you unless you get degrees. So some of us got degrees, and they also told us, and by the way, you're going to have to get dressed up. So we got dressed up. Now, you know what happens when you testify at hearings? If you only get about 10 people to show up, or 15 people, say, you might get 10 minutes each, your big day in the sun, to use the democratic process to tell the regulatory agency what they should be doing. If you do a little better and actually get maybe 50 supporters out there, they're probably going to tell you, well, we can only give you 3 minutes each now since we don't really have that much time. And one would wonder, if this is what democracy is, what happens if you have 1,000 people out there? Are you down to 12 seconds each? So obviously I'm trying to get us to think about democracy here and what it really means practically today in the regulatory agencies, in the courts, on the streets. Most of what you get after testifying in a regulatory agency is something like this. Thank you for your comments. Next. And it doesn't matter whether you scream, you sing, you bring children, you bring vegetables, you recite the Declaration of Independence, you'll get the same thing at the end. Thank you for your comments. Next. Many of you have probably heard that hundreds of times. I know I have. So what happens at these hearings? What's the result of the hearings? Well, take an example of the mom-and-pop gas station, the kind that there used to be at every little crossroads, and they would sell various kinds of food items and emergency nails and gloves and so on and so forth. Many of them have gone out of business. They've lost their permits, and they've gone into bankruptcy to clean up from the leakage from underground petroleum tanks and so on. Compare that example to a giant strip mining operation that will threaten aquifers throughout a whole region and plans to strip mine tens of thousands of acres in several counties. Chances are, at the same regulatory agency, that large energy company will not only get permits, it will get a government subsidy, and it will probably get a further government subsidy because the conditions of those permits will not be enforced. Or take another example. If you live in any kind of urban area and you want to screen in your porch, you probably are required to get something like 17 permits to do that. You would think that you were trying to cause a major natural and social cataclysm by doing this. And the fact of the matter is that probably the only way you'll ever get it done is if you sneak out in the middle of the night and use a stealth hammer to do it. Now, I want you to contrast that with the corporation that wants to put in a major toxic waste dump between a school and a church and a playground. In general, and I'm sure all of you can think of dozens of examples of this, the regulatory agency will find a way to make it legal through variances, exemptions, and other various special deals, no matter how many people come to testify about it with their 2 minutes each or 30 seconds each or whatever they're getting that day. It's true that once in a while we have a victory. I think we have to admit that most of the time our victories are small or partial or temporary or all three. Well, we tend to do this sort of one piece at a time. I'm sure you've heard this litany before, one chemical at a time, one company at a time, one factory at a time, kind of dump by dump by dump. I think we have to be asking ourselves, are we really getting at the fundamental issues? Many of our controversies, for good reason, have focused on food. We all have to eat food, we're all concerned with food, and let's face it, we've done a lot of foods. Probably among the people in this room, we've done hundreds of different kinds of foods. Sometimes we do meat food. Remember tuna fish controversy and boycott, okay? Remember beef. There are several different beef ones, actually. Remember the canned meat company, the big bad one. Hormel, remember that? There's probably others. Remember us doing drinks. I can remember a long time ago doing that one beer which no one would ever be caught dead with. Remember that one? Okay. Remember the wine? Remember the orange juice? Remember the current soft drink thing? Remember RBGH and milk? And we could go on from here. Do you remember grapes? Lettuce? Flavor Saver tomato? Roundup Ready soybeans? We could go on and on. This is my point, folks. There are lots of vegetables out there. There are lots of fruits out there. There are lots of chemicals. We haven't even done all those acronym chemicals. And so much of the time, we end up doing these one at a time. Now, we can look over at the corporations and say, are the corporations worried about this? Well, let's become flies on the wall and go into the boardroom of a corporation where they're having a conversation, where a member of the board of directors says, what are those activists up to? What are the environmentalists doing these days anyway? And suppose there's a response from another member of the staff. That member of the staff would probably say, well, they read our reports. They're speaking our language. They found some experts and they managed to hire themselves a lawyer. They're putting out lots of press releases. Some of them got degrees. They're acting respectful. And right about now, they're all over in the DNR, or the Department of Environmental whatever, in hearings room 301, where they've all got 90 seconds to tell us why they don't like us. And by the way, they're all dressed up. My point being, not to minimize any of these issues or any of our victories, but we're not getting far enough, fast enough, to make the amount of difference that we need to make. Just a quick view of what remedies we usually use against corporations. Well, we can fine them. And what do they do if they get a reasonably substantial fine? Well, they either raise prices, lower wages, lower benefits, demand more government subsidies, or threaten to move somewhere else. Okay? What if we cause them enough trouble that they have to launch a really expensive and large public relations blitz? How do they pay for that? Well, they raise prices, or lower wages, or cut benefits, or seek more government subsidies, or move somewhere else. And what if we really, really catch them with a huge fine and huge damage awards? And you could probably rattle off a number of companies this has happened to in the last 5 or 10 years. What do then? They go bankrupt. Okay, so this is a really convenient no-lose situation for them. So I think we need to ask, why aren't we getting further faster? I think a large part of the answer is that while we are doing things one at a time, and we're essentially pleading with boards or pleading with regulatory agencies to please follow the law or enforce it, corporations have been going around doing something very different. They've been changing the ground rules. They've been doing what I call downsizing democracy, and they've been making of it what I think is now little more than a theme park, where we can go through the motions, but nothing is connected to anything. Now, I think it's useful at this point to go extremely quickly to the founding parents of this nation. And without excusing any of their major oversights, I think they understood one thing very well, and that is that they were being oppressed by a very well-working combination of the monarchy and the corporations. And they no more wanted a king or a socially responsible king than they wanted corporations. So when they set up the new government in this nation, they didn't have kings and they didn't have corporations. They didn't plan on, again, allowing themselves to be subservient to corporations like the colonies themselves, or the British East India Company, or the Hudson Bay Company, or others. And they left to the states the role of chartering corporations. So since I'm from Wisconsin and I know more about that state than others, and since that's not atypical, I want to give you the example of 10 provisions that Wisconsin used to have in place that reflect how a sovereign people deals with its corporations that it has created, remember, for a public need and a public purpose. And I call them the Wisconsin Big Ten. And I want you to think how they reflect a different understanding, a different attitude, almost a different culture about what sovereign people are and what corporations are. Number one, corporations had a specific purpose. You're here to do this. It was often something like build and operate a railroad between two points or build a mill dam, something like that. Corporations were expected to fulfill but not exceed that purpose. Number two, if they did exceed that purpose, or if they did not fulfill it adequately, the state legislature revoked their charter. And this happened dozens and dozens of times and was a very common occurrence. They just revoked the charter. Third characteristic, these corporations had a limited lifespan, 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, 30 years. They were not set up in perpetuity, as is now the practice. Fourth characteristic, a corporation was prohibited from owning stock in other corporations. Now, that's very convenient. You know who did something, they put their name on it. They couldn't say, well, but we're half owned by them and a half subsidiary and half sister over this one, and these three people own another certain percent. This is the corporation, this is its stock, this is its name, and it's responsible and liable for various actions done in that name. Fifth characteristic was that other holdings of the corporation were prohibited. In other words, real estate holdings beyond the specific need of the corporation, see number one, purpose, were prohibited, as were various kinds of other speculations, stock speculations, and so on. Sixth characteristic, what we tend to identify today with stockholders, the fact that their liability is limited, was not necessarily the case. In many cases, stockholders were liable for anything the corporation did while they owned the stock, not just to the amount of their stock, but to however much else was owed. And this was true even if they later sold their stock. They were still responsible and liable for what happened while they had held it. Six, the legislature didn't hesitate to set rates and conditions under which corporations operated. Seven, corporations were prohibited unless their purpose was charitable or civic or educational. They were prohibited from giving to charity and other sort of civic pursuits. Why? For two reasons. Number one, it was regarded as a waste of stockholder resources. And number two, it was regarded as a way of preventing them from extending their influence in undue ways. Now, these last two are probably my favorites, 9 and 10. Number nine, all political contributions by corporations were prohibited. The language on this in Wisconsin is really inspiring, and it goes on to describe not just financial contributions to candidates, but all political activity of any kind. Corporations were to be kept out of the political process. And number 10, they had a really ambitious open records law, such that a committee of the legislature, which is what set up a corporation to begin with, a committee of the legislature could inspect any vaults, documents, records, papers, and on, of that corporation in order to determine what it was doing. And they also could examine under oath any officer, director, or employee, or stockholder of the corporation. Because they understood that if the state set up the corporation to serve a public interest and the public need, that they would need to know what on earth that corporation was doing. And the only way to do this is to see the records, all the records. Not a special report that they write up just because you want to hear about their minority hiring or their effort to eliminate some chemical. Anyway, those 10 provisions, I think, really reflect what a sovereign people does, or the kind of thing a sovereign people does when it believes it is in charge and corporations are to serve the people. Of course, the corporations had a response to this, and I'm just going to give you a quick sense of it. But every time the people succeeded in doing something, or some part of democracy worked for the people, the corporations didn't go in there with even more lawyers and more experts and so on. They changed the rules of the game so it wouldn't work next time. Some examples of that. There were many legal doctrines that were used for people to get legitimate damages from corporations. Doctrines like the doctrine of harms, of nuisance, of property, and of course, bankruptcy in another sense. All those doctrines were changed bit by bit in the courts by corporation lawyers to the point where they're basically now a support system for corporations. Another thing the corporations did was the states were really hard on them. Local governments, legislatures, and state courts really held corporations to many of the laws and provisions that I outlined. So corporations did anything they could to get out of there. They made an effort to get from state courts into federal courts, which we can talk about much later if anyone wants to. They made quite an effort to get out of the legislatures themselves and into something more protected. And the two things that were much more protected turned out to be regulatory agencies and courts. Corporations also, when a state passed a law that they didn't like, corporations also went to the Supreme Court and they said they can't do that because that interferes with interstate commerce. And by the late 19th century, they were able to carry this argument so that dozens and dozens of state laws were invalidated by the U.S. Supreme Court because they were a restraint of trade. Of course, this is the birth of baby NAFTA. It's an exact analogy to what's happening internationally now, where a claim of restraint of trade internationally is used to throw out national laws. Corporations also went out of their way in courts to get many rights that were not fully available to other citizens. Even before the Civil War, at a time, remember, when black Americans in the South were considered property, corporations got some of the rights of citizens in order to escape state courts. In 1886, in the famous Santa Clara decision, corporations got some of the rights of persons, specifically due process and equal protection before the law. That at a time decades before women could vote in federal elections. In the early 20th century, corporations got some Fourth Amendment rights of protection against unreasonable searches and seizures. This at a time when various courts were striking down worker compensation laws as unconstitutional. And finally, in the 1970s, the corporations are really moving along here. The corporations got significantly expanded freedom of speech rights, First Amendment rights to protection of commercial free speech. And in a recent Vermont case involving RBGH, it's really hurts that both sides assumed, this wasn't even argued, both sides assumed that corporations have First Amendment rights not only to free speech, but to not speak. In other words, to not label things. So corporations just went right for the ground rules. They didn't mess around with this one chemical at a time kind of thing. Corporations essentially followed the map that was left by people's successes in order to get away from the influence of peoples and get out of state jurisdiction, get away from legislatures, and into regulatory agencies and courts. In other words, they changed the ground rules to give them more rights and decrease the rights of persons. Now, in our activism, I think whatever our specific issues are, we need to always be thinking about changing the ground rules too. And a lot of this we can do by looking at the map that the corporations left as they tried to take apart the rights of human beings. And I think that in doing so, we can both work on our issues and begin to restore our democracy so that it's something more than the cheap thrills democracy theme park that we're left with now. As David Corton pointed out and others have, it's no accident that the era of regulatory agencies coincides exactly with the era of big corporations. They were, in fact, pretty much set up to serve them and have done this very well. If nothing else, they're a wonderful obstacle that keeps the people from getting at the two groups they could be really angry at. Number one, the corporations, and number two, their elected officials. Both of them alike point to the regulatory agencies over here where all these experts are supposed to be taking care of things. Well, if you've spent much time in the regulatory agencies, you probably know how that usually turns out. So I think that we need to stop asking questions like, does corporation A have the right to buy up and use patents and control a market? Or does this corporation have the right to decide who gets health care? Or does a certain corporation have the right to move their factory to Malaysia after gathering millions of dollars in subsidies and so on? And we need to start asking, do corporations have rights? Where do we get this notion that they have rights, or Bill of Rights rights, of persons? I think it's really appalling that we make so many distinctions among corporations, profit versus nonprofit, domestic versus foreign, media and otherwise. There are special laws for insurance corporations and banking corporations and so on. But our laws increasingly make no distinction between the rights of human persons and the rights of corporate persons. I think regulatory agencies are worthless if all that happens in them is we get patted on the head and told what good little citizens we've been, but if we don't have any real input. They say something like, thank you for your comments, now run along home and we'll take care of it. I think that pulling the lever in the voting booth is a sham if the lever isn't connected to anything or if someone else chooses all the options. We're acting like the only measure of a real democracy is whether or not we get shot at on the way to the polls, when in fact they're just letting us play with the knobs. So each time I evaluate a strategy, I ask one question first, and that is, would this strategy change the ground rules to give people more power or not? And if it's not, then I try and look for a strategy that will do that as well as address the specific issue I'm concerned with. Now, thinking over our time in the regulatory agencies and with much of our other activism, we did learn to speak their language, and we stopped speaking our own. We did read their reports, and then we let them frame the issue. We did get experts and lawyers, and then we let them determine the process that was relevant. We did learn how to make press releases. To do what? To fit the format of the corporate media. We did act respectful while we were being lied to, implicitly legitimizing their right to lie. And we did get degrees, and we did get all dressed up in hopes of getting special considerations and concessions from them. I think a lot of what's happened is that we have been censoring ourselves. We haven't been talking about our real needs or real democracy anymore because people tell us that that would make us sound unrealistic or radical. I think we have to stop censoring ourselves and relearn step by step how to live and how to think as sovereign people. We've just gotten out of the habit. No one can do this for us, but I think we have some good guides, and they've been referred to frequently during this weekend. The founding parents, though they were certainly not strong on multiculturalism, they certainly knew that they didn't want the corporations running the state. The populists of 100 years ago knew that you had to do more than just define yourselves and define your democracy. You had to keep defining yourselves and keep defining your democracy. And I want to mention as a last guide the civil rights activists of the last half century, because even when many others were telling them, look, we've just got to do our best working with this separate but equal doctrine and prove these schools aren't equal. And they said, but that's wrong. They said, well, you can't say separate but equal is wrong. They'll say you're radical. You know, they'll say you're being unrealistic. You're just in a dream world. But I'm really glad that about at the midpoint of this century, they recognized that and they said, no, you know what? Separate but equal is wrong. It's shocking. It's unconstitutional. It's got to go. And that wasn't enough to begin to achieve things. That wasn't a sufficient condition, but it was a necessary beginning. And I hope we can do the same thing thinking about democracy and corporations. Thank you.
That was Jane Ann Morris, recorded by C-SPAN in 1996 in Texas at the founding convention of the Alliance for Democracy. The 2010 Supreme Court decision in the Citizens United case was handed down 4 years later. A link to the film is on her website, democracythemepark.org. Jane Ann Morris died on May 28, 2019, in Madison, Wisconsin, of ALS, also known as Lou Gehrig's disease. She was one of the primary researchers, writers, and workshop leaders in POCLAD, the Program on Corporations, Law, and Democracy. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. There you can also subscribe to weekly free podcasts. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening. Give us a call.